This is your Monday Takeaway podcast for February 26th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillig. Thank you so much for being with us today. Well, the skates have been packed away. The skis are gone. The high-tech skin-tight bodysuits sent to the cleaners. The 2018 Winter Games in Pyeongchang, South Korea is now one for the record books. The closing ceremonies were last night, complete with a K-pop dance party that you hear a little bit behind me there. The United States did not come away with the most medals. That honor goes to winter powerhouse Norway. But America had some truly great moments. We here on The Takeaway were 100% behind the U.S. women's hockey team, who beat rival Canada and won their first gold since 1998.
Must beat Rooney to keep Canada's hopes alive. She is stuck! The United States wins gold in Pyeongchang!
And how about this call? Kicken Randall and Jesse Diggins, America's first ever gold in cross-country skiing in the freestyle sprint.
They're all completely gassed! They've given it everything on the global buckets! Yes!
Jesse Diggins, yes! To the line!
Yes!
And it is,
yes!
Jesse Diggins!
Oh!
Delivering a landmark moment that will be etched in U.S. Olympic history.
I love that call. And how about another first? People might giggle, listen, when they hear about curling. But they weren't laughing when the U.S. men won its first ever gold.
This is a potential double for five and maybe gold for the U.S. Can he get it? He can! Five on the board for Team USA!
Gold for Team USA in curling. Look, the United States was fourth in the medal count behind Germany and Canada, and of course, Norway. But that's still pretty great. Curling gold, hockey gold, cross-country skiing gold for the Americans. Congratulations. And it's not over yet. In less than 2 weeks, the Paralympic Winter Games kick off in Pyeongchang. Well, let's go to Washington now and get the latest developments in the Russia investigation. New charges were filed against former Trump aides Paul Manafort and Rick Gates last week. Then over the weekend, a new memo from Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee. And to understand that memo, you have to remember this.
Release the memo.
Review the memo.
Not only have I seen the memo, but as a member of the Intel Committee, I've been aware and have been helpful in creating this memo.
Shocking memo circulating in Congress.
Everybody wants to see the memo.
Release the memo.
By releasing the memo,
we ought to see the memo.
When are we going to get the memo?
Weeks of drumbeat in the media led up to the release of a memo from Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee on February 2nd, its chairman, Devin Nunes. It alleged that the FBI abused its power and misled the FISA court when it applied to conduct surveillance on another Trump aide, Carter Page. Well, Democrats said the so-called Nunes memo was highly misleading. The head of the FBI said that also. So Democrats fought to get their rebuttal to that memo public. And over the weekend, it became public. Congressman Adam Schiff of California is the lead Democrat on the Intel Committee.
So I'm not surprised the president doesn't like it. I'm not surprised, frankly, that the White House tried to bury this memo response as long as they could. But it's important for the public to see the facts that the FBI acted appropriately in seeking a warrant on Carter Page. They're not part of some deep state, as the president apparently would like the public to believe.
Well, let's get some analysis of the Democratic memo and what it says about the Russia investigation now. Ryan Goodman is a former special counsel at the Department of Defense, a professor at NYU Law School, and co-editor-in-chief of Just Security. Ryan, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Ryan, the Nunes memo that we mentioned that Republicans released some weeks ago had some very specific claims. Republicans said that the Department of Justice in October of 2016 obtained a FISA warrant to spy on Carter Page and supported that application with the Steele memo from former British spy Christopher Steele, but that they didn't tell the judge that the Steele memo was funded in part by partisan Democrats, by the Clinton campaign, by the Democratic National Committee, basically that partisan opposition research was the basis of that application, of the Mueller investigation, of the entire investigation into Russian meddling in the campaign, essentially. What does the latest Democratic rebuttal have to say about that?
So the Democratic rebuttal is actually pretty specific on that issue. And it's not just a he said, he said. in this instance, but rather there's a specific quoting from the original FISA application, so the application for the surveillance warrant. And in it, the Democratic memo says, and it quotes, a block quote from the FBI and the Department of Justice, which says, quote, the FBI speculates that, the sources that were behind the Steele dossier were, quote, likely looking for information that could be used to discredit, end quote, the Trump campaign. It says Candidate One's campaign, but everybody knows what that is. So it was actually very explicit in the original application that the FBI and the Department of Justice informed the court of the political origins of the dossier and therefore gave the judges the ability to determine themselves whether or not the dossier could be reliable for whatever purposes they were using it on the basis of knowing its origin. So that really does kind of, for lack of a better way of putting it, I don't want to exaggerate the point, but it kind of blows out of the water the idea that the FBI didn't tell the court that this was originally a politically motivated source of funding for the dossier.
Ryan, wasn't the entire basis of the Nunes memo and the outrage around it that the FBI misled the FISA court and spied on an American citizen? Now you're saying that's not true.
That's right. This really does go to the heart of what's in the Nunes memo. There are other parts of the Nunes memo that also are kind of significantly undermined, let's say, by the Democrats' memo. For example, the Democrats' memo refers to the fact that there was, quote, multiple independent sources, end quote, that corroborated the Steele dossier. So it's not even that the Steele dossier was the sole source of information by any stretch. And in fact, something that we did know in some of the conversations that came out after the Nunes memo, that there were independent Republican-appointed judges that on three separate later occasions also approved their surveillance warrant. This actually identifies which president appointed each of them. And the Democratic memo says what one would actually intuit, but it just flatly says, these judges approved the surveillance warrant over time because the surveillance was, in fact, picking up valuable information, which is further corroboration that they had the right person.
So, Ryan, what blanks have been filled in for you now after these two memos in terms of Carter Page's possible relationships with Russians and the Kremlin and the government's investigation into his activities? And he's not alone. Other people like him.
So I think what this piece adds, if you look at the two memos together, is two concerning issues. One, the Democratic memo also mentions that the evidence that they then had from the FBI on Carter Page contradicted what Page testified to the Congress. So I think it raises the specter of yet another Trump associate who didn't just lie to the media about Russian contacts, but seems to have, or allegedly, according to the memo, lied or misled Congress. So that starts to raise a question about, was there something behind this? It's not just all these individuals independently deciding to lie. I think that's a very serious concern, and Special Counsel Mueller in his investigations is throwing the book at people if they lie to federal authorities. So I think that's one important building block here. The second is the Democratic memo seems to suggest that Carter Page was approached by the Russians with information that the Russians had derogatory information on Hillary Clinton. That would be very significant. We do know that George Papadopoulos, a foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign, was approached by the Russians and told that they had thousands of Clinton emails. That's in his plea agreement. We do know that Donald Trump Jr. had those emails that said that the Russian government, in its effort to help Mr. Trump, had dirt on Hillary Clinton that they were going to offer them in the Trump Tower June 9th meeting. This would be the third, and that would really add to a pattern of multiple overtures by the Russians and no indication that the Trump campaign was anything but receptive.
Ryan, there's another question here that's awfully basic, and it has me troubled and maybe some other people too. How could Devin Nunes and his cohorts on the House Intelligence Committee have made so much outrage over release the memo and the idea that the Department of Justice abused the FISA system by not telling judges that the Steele memo was essentially partisan when it's pretty clear verbatim that they did? How can they do that?
I think that the problem here is they can quite easily feed a conspiracy mill just by creating an image that there was something nefarious or wrong going on the part of the FBI and trying to in some ways damage the FBI and its reputation. Why did President Trump release the memo on a Saturday morning, right? The Democratic memo on a Saturday morning. And then President Trump tweets out that it vindicates him again, not just that the Nunes memo vindicated him, which it didn't, but the idea that the Democratic memo vindicates him. Unfortunately, I think that there's a large swath of the American public that just doesn't get all the information. So what they do get is the Nunes attempt to dress this up as some kind of conspiracy, which really isn't there. There might be other conspiracies. There might be wrongdoing on the part of the FBI. I can easily see that. But this isn't one of them.
And even Americans who do get both sides of this story, Ryan, and maybe that's part of the problem, both sides, if they would have heard about the Nunes memo saying the Department of Justice was abusive, and then the Democratic memo saying, no, it wasn't, and they knew it, isn't there a risk they sort of come away from this saying, well, one side says it was bad, the other side says it wasn't, that's politics, kind of throw up their hands?
That's exactly right. They say, the truth is not accessible. And actually, the truth is accessible, you know. And it, you know, if you go into the details, for example, between the dueling memos, it's not just the memos against each other were Republicans against Democrats. Christopher Wray, the FBI director, said about the Nunes memo that he didn't want it released because of all the factual omissions made it very misleading. He has not said anything like that about the Schiff memo, the Democratic memo. So there are independent authorities or sources that can try to help us assess it, but I do think that many people walk away thinking, all these facts flying at me, this is hyper-politicized, I don't know what to believe.
Ryan Goodman is a former special counsel at the Defense Department, a professor at NYU Law School, and co-editor-in-chief of Just Security. A week after the deadly school shooting in Parkland, Florida, National Rifle Association Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre made his first public remarks since the killings at the annual CPAC conference. That's the Conservative Political Action Conference in Maryland this year, saying that opportunists were seeking to exploit tragedy for political gain.
Their goal is to eliminate the Second Amendment and our firearms freedoms so they can eradicate all individual freedoms.
The NRA is a longtime sponsor of CPAC, but there are signs that their anti-gun control stance might be harder to sustain in the court of public opinion than it was before. Several large companies announced last week and over the weekend that they were cutting business partnerships and ending discount offerings for NRA members. That suggests that normal marketing arrangements are now getting too toxic for corporate America if the partner is the NRA. Marty Lanzini-Murray is a retired teacher and a public school administrator in Florida, and she recently re-upped her membership in the NRA, and she did it because she says she wants to see the organization change, and she wants to be part of that change from within.
This is my third time joining, and the first time was in the 60s when my husband and I were members, and we were hunters, and we were college students then and didn't have a lot of extra money, and so we let our membership lapse. Joined again in the 80s when my husband also, who is a Vietnam veteran, he was a member when we married. It was a second marriage, and we kept that membership up for several years, again, being hunters, but then let that membership lapse because we stopped hunting. And it was after the killings at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School that I thought it was time to join again, because I've been a member of the organization before, and I wanted to be a voice within the organization as a person who believes in Second Amendment rights and also as a person who has been in a school and been a teacher as well as an administrator in a public school in Florida.
So how do you think your voice, Marty, could benefit the NRA? I mean, you're aware of their policy standpoints. You see how the NRA argues in public for Second Amendment rights. You believe in those rights. Why do you think they need your voice here?
I think my voice and the voice of a lot of the members in the NRA, I have friends who are members of the NRA also, and I believe that people like myself can make a difference if we keep our voices heard. So many people have come out and have said there are certain things that we need to do to protect our Second Amendment rights as well as protect people who would be hurt by guns. And so I'd like to see the face of the NRA change to reflect changing laws. My husband is a Vietnam veteran. He's actually battlefield wounded. And the weapon that he carried in Vietnam is very similar to the weapon that's sold today, and I believe its name is an AR-15. And in my mind, that kind of weapon needs to be in the hands of military people and law enforcement, not in the hands of citizens like myself. I'd also like to see high-capacity magazines not available, because in schools, the killing zone is because there are high-capacity weapons with magazines that shoot many, 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 many rounds rapidly. And so I'd like to see magazines limited in their size. I'd also like to see more background checks, people's criminal histories available for purchase of weapons. And mental health is kind of a touchy subject because mental health is protected by HIPAA laws, and also being mentally ill doesn't mean that you're going to commit a terrible crime. But there is mental health available. You can find information about people because of court-ordered mental health treatment, and so that could be a part of background checks. And in addition, I'd like to see research on guns, weapons, violence in media, and mental health. I'd like to see more research done on how these all go together.
Well, Marty, you're for an assault weapons ban. You're for universal background checks, for banning bump stocks and high-capacity clips. Polls show that most Americans agree with you on all of these points, but none of these are the position of the NRA. In fact, the NRA fights tooth and nail in Washington against any of the changes that you're talking about. What do you think is going on in that organization?
I really couldn't say with purpose that I know what's going on. I think there has to be a change in the culture and the way the leaders lead the organization. And there is one thing I do know, and that is doing nothing is doing something. And so with the number of Americans who are interested in this issue, something needs to be done. And I would also ask that like-minded individuals like myself join the NRA so that our voices can be heard within the organization.
What's next? What are you going to do to try to change the stances of this organization that's built up a public profile and a legislative stance and a relationship with members of Congress all over the map for decades?
I'm going to do what one small voice can do. I'm going to keep talking. I'm going to keep pressing on this issue. I'm going to write to my legislators, and I'm going to visit them in their offices. Every time a constituent calls a legislator, even a phone call is recorded as a vote for one thing or another. And every one of our elected officials has a way of keeping track of this. And so I think common people like myself with no particular wealth or powerful position, common people can make a difference. We can change. We just have to not give up. And again, I would have my voice be heard in the NRA by letting them know how I feel.
Marty Lenzini-Murray is a retired teacher and public school administrator and a member for the third time of the National Rifle Association. Marty, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Americans everywhere, inside the NRA and outside, are talking about what we can do to prevent another tragedy like Parkland. Well, last week we asked you what changes to U.S. gun policy you want to see, and we got an overwhelming response from a lot of you who are gun owners and many of you who aren't.
Hi, my name is Richard Davis from Westford, Massachusetts. Every time a politician or any citizen at all says my Second Amendment rights, I'm in favor of Second Amendment rights, they are basically acceding the conversation to the NRA, who is defining what those Second Amendment rights are. Instead, we should be talking about that issue And what is the Second Amendment? And what does it say? And what does it allow us to do?
This is about the Second Amendment for Richard. For some of you, it's about money. From Jersey City, New Jersey, there's a large gun manufacturer in Florida that builds assault weapons. The state gave them tax breaks. There's too much money involved.
I don't see a real change in any gun policy until we get politicians out of the pockets of NRA lobbyists. Mario from Salem, Oregon.
Hi, this is Mitch Walker calling from Florence, South Carolina. I do not own a firearm at this time, but I have in the past. I think insurance for liability from misuse, probably have to prove your insurance coverage when you buy ammunition. That would make sense to me. The biggest thing that we need to do is lift the veil of liability protection from the manufacturers, because if we make them potential targets in wrongful death lawsuits, I think they'll take care of a lot of this on their own.
We got this message from Indianapolis, Indiana. Require training, passing a test, and insurance, just like you have to drive a car.
I'm Ellen, and I live in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I grew up on a farm in rural East Texas with guns as a part of everyday life. I live in a city now. No gun needed. We must close the gun show background loophole now.
The gun show loophole, that allows people to buy guns at gun shows where background checks are not always required like they are at licensed gun shops. Then there's the issue of training. Is carrying a gun on the street or in a classroom or anywhere else enough for protection if an assault happens?
My name is Anna, and I'm from Orlando, Florida. I am a gun owner, and I support the right of responsible Americans to own guns, and I support tougher gun restrictions. In my opinion, obtaining a permit should be required for any gun purchase or ownership. Speaking as someone who has a permit, no criminal record, and no mental illness, the class I was required to take did not prepare me to use a gun. I chose not to carry my weapon until I felt I would be able to use it and use it effectively in an emergency situation, which took a lot more classes and practice than legally required.
Now, some of you say that the laws we already have on the books are enough and that they just need to be enforced. From Louisville, Kentucky, one listener writes, I do not support any changes to gun laws. We should enforce the laws we have on the books. And yes, I am a gun owner, but my father was shot and killed with a handgun, and I still don't blame the gun. I blame the person. And some of you suggest putting the onus on manufacturers.
This is Ronnie in Detroit. The casualty surcharge is a gun policy idea I assimilated from law professor Christian Turner. We can make firearms manufacturers start internalizing the negative externalities of their business by requiring them to pay an actuarially established value to, say, the Department of Health and Human Services for each death or injury attributable to their respective arms sales.
Thanks to all of you for weighing in on this critical conversation in America. Your voice is the most important part of what we do here on The Takeaway, and you've had so much to say since Parkland and even before. And we want you to keep driving our conversation. Stay with us. March 5th is the date that's been in the front of the minds of about 700,000 undocumented young people protected from deportation under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival programs, otherwise known as DACA. Back in September, President Trump set March 5th as the day he was rescinding DACA unless Congress can come up with a fix. Earlier this year, a federal judge in the Ninth Circuit called that decision unconstitutional, and the Trump administration then appealed. Well, today, the Supreme Court declined to hear that appeal until the lower court makes a ruling in the case. And court watchers say that means the government must continue to renew DACA applications, and the March 5th deadline rescinding DACA effectively goes away, for now, at least. But with the lower court case still pending and without congressional action so far, these young people's futures are still uncertain. And it's an even tougher environment for DACA students living in conservative states where leaders oppose the program, states like Texas. Last year, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton led 10 states in suing the federal government trying to overturn DACA. Kurt Carapeza manages the higher education desk for our partner WGBH in Boston. He recently went to El Paso, Texas, right on the U.S.-Mexico border, and visited a college campus there to get a closer look at DACA in a red state and how the situation compares with college students living in a blue state like Massachusetts. Kirk, welcome.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, Kirk, why did you choose UT El Paso? Why did it attract you?
Todd, the campus is about 500 yards from the border. You can actually see the border fence from the UTEP campus, which is planted right in the barren foothills overlooking Mexico. On campus, border security agents on bikes often patrol the paths, so the threat of deportation for DACA students is real. And we really wanted to ask young people living, working, and studying in this environment how their lives have changed since 2012. That's when the Obama administration enacted DACA. Are they doing better or worse than 6 years ago? So to find out, we took this road trip. We went to the West Texas city to get the outside story far from Washington.
Well, Kirk, are there a lot of DACA recipients at UTEP? What did you learn?
There are. Administrators don't track the number, but they estimate they're anywhere between 200 to 400, which, you know, compared to schools here in Massachusetts and New England, is a lot. And in blue states, like here in Massachusetts, we've seen many colleges ask staff to step up and help these students who are enrolled in the DACA program. In Texas, it's a very different story. First of all, Todd, just consider these numbers. Nearly 80% of all DACA recipients are from Mexico, and 45% are enrolled in school. In Texas, 113,000 young people have signed up for the program. That's compared to only 6,000 here in Massachusetts. And in Texas, state leaders oppose DACA, so the ongoing immigration debate in Washington is putting a lot of stress on DACA students at the University of Texas, El Paso, students like Roberto Valadez.
I used to excel in school, and then in middle school, when I found out I was undocumented, I just gave up. I was like, yeah, what for? I can't go to college, and I can't get a job if I go to college. So why even try?
His parents brought him and his sister from Juarez to El Paso when he was just 1 year old. And when Valadez turned five, his parents had the talk. They sat him down and told him that he was undocumented. It wasn't until middle school, though, that Valadez realized the consequences. And he told me that that's when he lost focus.
Well, there's some despair in Roberto's voice there. But Kirk, then things changed in 2012, right? Because President Obama established DACA and spared people like Roberto at least the threat of deportation.
Right. He immediately got a customer service job there in El Paso. He obtained a Texas driver's license. And for the first time, he traveled outside the county without the fear of being caught and deported. Above all, though, Valadez told me that DACA gave him hope.
Now I'm going to go to school. Now I know it's for a purpose. Like, now I know what the end goal is. I know what I can do. It was like my golden ticket. Like, everything changed.
And after graduating from high school, he enrolled in college, paying full out-of-state tuition, like most DACA students, and he graduated from UTEP in December. When he was on campus, he had founded a group called Education Not Deportation, and he's been urging administrators to be more vocal in support of DACA, calling for more scholarships for undocumented students.
But Kirk, then there's this contrast between how Hispanics across the nation seem to view DACA versus those in Texas. Support among Hispanics nationwide for DACA is over 95%. In Texas, again, a conservative red state, it's a lot different.
That's right. A statewide poll found one in four Hispanics in Texas want to end DACA. And these were some of the most surprising voices we heard in El Paso. These are young Hispanic Republicans who oppose the program. Oscar Sanchez is president of the College Republicans. The 20-year-old conservative voted for Trump. He wants to build up the wall. And he thinks giving DACA recipients legal status completely undermines immigration law.
It's not fair for other immigrants, like my parents, for example. My mom being from right here, Juarez, right across the border, and my dad from Chihuahua, which is like 4 or 5 hours away from here. He works in manufacturing. He just worked his way up and ended up getting good salaries as the older he got, and he lives the American dream.
Kirk, Oscar is telling you essentially that his parents played by the rules, but of course, one of the difficult parts of the reality of DACA recipients is that they were brought here to the U.S. as children. They didn't decide to break the law, and in many cases would have to go back to countries that they know little or nothing about. So how does that play into what Latino students at UTEP or across Texas have to say about it?
These conservative Latino students we spoke with were certainly sympathetic, and they don't blame DACA students who came here as children. Instead, they blame their parents. Here's Peter Leyva. He's 23. He's in his final year at UTEP. He's a big Trump supporter. When I met him on campus, he was wearing a Make America Great Again t-shirt. He has family in Juarez, and he says he understands the challenges of living in a violent city, but he also opposes DACA.
As someone whose family waited in line to get citizenship, get naturalized, all the rest of it, I've always been opposed to letting illegal immigrants have a free pass.
Kirk, I can see why in a place like Texas, they're pretty divided lines, sort of two sides to this debate. But I also suspect that it's a lot more nuanced than that.
That's right. Not everyone I spoke with was as strident. I talked with 19-year-old Ana Cepeda. She said she doesn't like the idea of a pathway to citizenship for DACA recipients, but she is willing to bend a bit.
I'd support permanent residency. Citizenship is pushing it, but without chain migration, I think that would be a fair compromise.
And Todd, it's worth noting that Cepeda, like many of the young Republicans on campus, doesn't know any DACA students, and she objects to private donors giving them scholarships. We should also point out DACA students can receive state and college financial aid, but they are not eligible for federal grants for low-income students.
Kirk Carapeza with the Higher Education Desk at WGBH in Boston. Kirk, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
We'll keep covering this story this week with more on what the Supreme Court's decision means for DACA recipients and what's going on in Congress. Many Americans have a picture in their minds about the rise and fall of Detroit, the prosperous home of American industrialization, and then the stunning decline that left the city bankrupt and its people motivated to move away. That's a brief outline, but it turns out there's much, much more to Detroit's story.
What I wanted to do in this book was to actually look at the earliest moments of Detroit's formation and think about it in a different way, and to try to see the people who were actually being exploited, whose labor was being stolen in the process of developing this place.
That's Taya Miles, a professor at the University of Michigan and author of The Dawn of Detroit, A Chronicle of Slavery and Freedom in the City of the Straits. Taya Miles sat down with WNYC's Rebecca Carroll as part of our book series, Reading the Reckoning.
Hey, Taya.
Hi, Rebecca.
So I want to just get right started to it. How did you arrive at the story, or what drew you to it?
I was drawn to the story because of what was surrounding me living here in Michigan over the last 6 to 10 years. On the one hand, there were all of these national narratives circulating that were quite negative about Detroit. Detroit was being figured as a place of ruin, a place that was corrupt. And the bankruptcy of the city in 2013 only added to all of the negativity that was going on in conversations about the city. And I experienced this just as someone who was often traveling through the Detroit airport and on flights going around the country. When people learned that I was flying back to Detroit, they would ask me questions about, oh my goodness, how bad is it there? So Detroit was really getting a lot of unfair, negative, even, I think, libelous press.
And so what did your sort of findings about Detroit in the 18th century, what can it tell us about Detroit in the 21st century?
The similarities are actually a little bit haunting,
right.
I think.
Right.
Because in the 18th century, first of all, Detroit was an indigenous place. And then the French decided to start a fur trading military fort on the Detroit River. French settlers came in. And then when the French lost a big war to Great Britain, British settlers came in. And then, as we know, the British lost a big war to the Americans, and the American settlers came in. And throughout these various processes of colonialism, numerous people were doing their best to grab indigenous land and to make a profit through that land by using enslaved labor. Detroit was being perceived as an empty place that was just there for the taking. And if you were a white man from New York, if you were a merchant, if you were able to get a government position and get your hands on some native land, you could really set yourself up and your family up for life in Detroit. And the similarities that I see really have to do with the way in which Detroit has, again, in our moment, been imagined as a place that is empty,
mm-hmm.
a place that has lost thousands of residents, a place where there are vacant lots,
mm-hmm.
and a place that needs to be claimed and transformed by outsiders with capital.
How do you feel like our education system is doing at teaching American history, particularly as it pertains to slave history?
Well, I had the good fortune of being able to work with students at the University of Michigan as I did research on this book and as I was writing it. And so I sort of had a ready-made audience and community of thinkers to share my research with as it developed. And during this stage, I was actually a little bit worried, a little concerned that students from the Detroit area, because we have many on campus, might actually feel that studying this topic would be just another example of hanging out Detroit's dirty laundry for outsiders to peer at. But they didn't have that view at all. They actually were really moved by the material, wanted to dive in, and some of them continued to do research with me about it after the end of our class. And I think the emotion that they shared the most was really outrage. They were offended. They were shocked that they had grown up in this place and walked the streets where enslaved people of indigenous and African descent had walked and labored and never heard a word about it. So they were angry. And instead of thinking that this was more negativity about Detroit, they interpreted it as a story that shows the great strength of people of color in Detroit. The ways in which, even though they were deprived of their liberty, they were able to fight against their oppressors to eventually gain their freedom and to help build the city that was later viewed as a great metropolis.
That's so interesting how, you know, even when we unveil these stories that more often than not have, you know, these kind of similar tent poles of colonization and haves and have-nots and, you know, racial denigration and whatnot, that they're out of that, the learning of that comes a kind of power in the anger and the rage and a kind of pride as well. You know, I don't know Detroit well, but the people that I do know from Detroit are extremely proud of their city. And I can understand as you're talking how learning about the history of it, particularly this history, would add to that sense of pride.
I have been struck by the reaction, feeling like this book provided evidence of something that they always knew was there but couldn't quite put their finger on. So one woman said that she's really glad that this book has shown where corruption really began in Detroit. It didn't begin with the black politicians, who are often held up as scapegoats in the national media or in popular imagination. It actually began with white explorers, white military officials, white merchants, white traders, who then became politicians in Detroit.
I love how also how you said, you know, that you've talked to some folks in Detroit who have, you know, learned about this book and of their history, and that they always knew something was there. It's like the force, you know. It's like there's something there. We just didn't know quite what it is. And I do think that in this country, black and brown people especially feel like there's something there that keeps us going. And we just have to tap into it. And so I think that you've done that with this book, and I thank you for doing that and for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks a lot, Rebecca.
WNYC's Rebecca Carroll there in conversation with Taya Miles about her book, The Dawn of Detroit, A Chronicle of Slavery and Freedom in the City of the Straits. It's just about time for us to go today, but hey, your voices are always a really important part of what we do here on The Takeaway. We play your reactions, we get experts to answer your questions on everything from healthcare to gun control to the Me Too movement. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can sign up for our Listener Response Network. We'll send you a few text messages every week about the topics that we're covering on the show. To sign up, just text the word START to 69866. Standard data and messaging rates apply, of course, and you can always text the word STOP to opt out. Again, text START to 69866 to join our Listener Response Network and become part of the conversation that you hear every day here on The Takeaway. And tomorrow, we look back at the 1994 assault weapons ban, how it was passed, and the political price that came along with it.
We lost 54, 55 House seats in that election in 94. That turned, and many, if not most, were from rural South and Midwest states or districts that were anti-gun control. And in most cases, if not all cases, the reason that was given for their loss was the assault weapon ban.
That's tomorrow on The Takeaway. In the meantime, thanks so much for being with us. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.